Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Phyllis Bennis with the Institute for Policy Studies, who examines the Bush administration's effort to gain approval of a UN resolution mandating tough new weapons inspections in Iraq and authority to launch a new war against Baghdad. Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights, who discusses new U.S. travel regulations that prompted Canada to issue a travel warning, advising some of its citizens not to visit America. And Father Roy Bourgeois, founder of the School of the Americas Watch, who talks about the continuing campaign and upcoming protest demanding closure of the U.S. Army's facility which trains Latin American soldiers. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The Guardian weekly newspaper reports that $18 million worth of anti-AIDS drugs destined for Africa were diverted and resold in Europe at an excessive profit. Originally, the drug Combivir was sold by drug giant GlaxoSmithKline at a deep discount to health clinics in the African nations of Senegal, Ivory Coast, Togo, and Guinea-Bissau under a program sponsored by the World Health Organization. According to reports, about one-third of the shipment was hijacked, shipped back to Europe, and sold at market prices by drug wholesalers. The revelation has shocked AIDS activists who have successfully pushed for affordable AIDS drugs for Africa in recent years. So far, two people have been arrested in the scam, a German businessman and a French pharmaceutical trader. The European Commission is currently crafting new guidelines with the aim of halting the smuggling of prescription drugs, with much tighter customs inspections. Through the tracing of batch numbers, the AIDS drugs were found to have been imported this summer to the Netherlands, Germany, and Britain. The pharmaceutical was sold at nearly $6 a tablet, up from 78 cents that GlaxoSmithKline first sold the drug to African clinics. Marat Fomenko, a fisherman from Kazakhstan's one-time port city of Aralsk, is packing his bags and leaving. It's been 25 years since he could see the receding waters of the Aral Sea, once the fourth largest lake in the world. Fishermen in this part of Central Asia were uprooted when the rivers that fed the Aral Sea were diverted to irrigate the now pesticide-laden cotton fields upstream in Uzbekistan. According to the Ecologist magazine, Fomenko has joined the ranks of 25 million environmental refugees who have fled due to floods, drought, soil erosion, clear-cutting of forests, or toxic waste spills. The residents of Ogoniland in Nigeria's Niger Delta continue to be displaced by oil exploitation done by Shell Oil Company with the support of the nation's corrupt military. Oil has made Ogoniland virtually unlivable. There are hundreds of oil spills annually, and drinking water is polluted. Climate change has the potential to create tens of millions of new ecological refugees who lack any of the international protections for people who flee political repression. In Bangladesh alone, 20 million people would be displaced if the water level rose 1 meter. Such mass migrations could be accompanied by new epidemics of disease. Some experts expect with global warming, mosquito-borne diseases would increase 100-fold in temperate regions. Over the next 50 years, Dr. Norman Myers of Oxford University believes that climate change would produce 150 million new environmental refugees. Last year, the stink at Inwood Dairy in downstate Illinois got so intense that local family farm activist Karen Hudson, a member of FARM, or Families Against Rural Messes, got in a small plane with a friend to take pictures of the pollution seeping from the dairy's lagoon. Soon afterwards, Hudson took up several local TV film crews to document what farm activists call the big spill, the release of massive amounts of animal waste from the site. The Illinois Attorney General opened an investigation, and in early May 2001, the Inwood Dairy agreed to pay a $50,000 fine for mishandling an estimated 40 million gallons of livestock waste. Still, Hudson doubts the settlement will stop factory farmers from dumping animal waste on local land and treating farmland as a septic system or an open sewer to dispose of the huge amount of animal waste created every day. According to The Nation magazine, giant agribusinesses like Inwood Dairy are now trying to prevent more exposés of factory farms. They are pushing a bill in the Illinois legislature that would ban overflights of land to photograph or videotape a factory farm without the owner's permission. Farm activists are also under personal attack from corporate interests. Jimmy Newhoff of the North Carolina Port Council has compared Family Farm activists to the September 11th terrorists. In a recent newsletter column, he wrote, "Both groups distort the truth to further their agendas. Both groups have no regard for the damage levied on innocent victims." This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Sasha Summer Cousineau.
Since the Bush administration began beating the drums of war against Iraq this past summer, the United Nations has been placed at the center of debate on the question of renewed weapons inspections and the legitimacy of any future U.S. attack. France, Russia, and China, three of the five permanent members of the Security Council, each with veto power, have objected to the White House demand for a single resolution mandating a tough new round of weapons inspections, which, if impeded by Baghdad, would automatically authorize a U.S. invasion. Instead, France, Russia, and China have advocated a set of two resolutions, one laying out conditions for weapons inspections and a second resolution when and if Saddam Hussein's government fails to comply. But over the past 7 weeks, Secretary of State Colin Powell has worked behind the scenes applying heavy pressure to U.S. allies on the Security Council to accede to Washington's plan. As a result, a compromise resolution may soon be approved by the Council that could adopt ambiguous language that would satisfy both President Bush's pursuit of war-making authority and those that oppose it. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Phyllis Bennis, a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, who examines the high-stakes negotiations at the UN and continuing international opposition to a U.S.-led war against Iraq.
Mexico, France, Russia, and the other members of the Security Council have succeeded in forcing the U.S. to make needed concessions in the resolution that the U.S. has had on the table for the last several weeks. We don't know the details. There are indications that enough serious concessions, as opposed to cosmetic concessions, have been made that most or possibly even all the countries on the Council might be prepared to sign off on a new text, a text that, according to the Mexican Foreign Minister, for example, Jorge Castaneda, said that the new text reflects a large number of changes introduced by France, by Russia, and by Mexico that give diplomacy a chance.
There's a lot at stake in terms of the wording of this resolution. Semantics will play a large role, reports say, about future U.S. justification for an invasion. Material breach are two words that the Bush administration could use in a future attack, and reports are that France and other nations are kind of wary of including those two words in the resolution.
That's right, Scott. The fear is, I think, in fact, that the U.S. will make its decision on whether or not to go to war against Iraq disregarding whatever the resolution says, disregarding the United Nations, and frankly, probably disregarding what the U.N. weapons inspectors find or don't find in Iraq. There's the sense, and I agree with it, that the Bush administration's decision-making has little to do with what the international community says. Having said that, it still matters a lot what the resolution actually says. If the resolution, for instance, in fact said that if there are future Iraqi violations, all necessary force should be used, or something like that, the U.S. would easily be able to claim that it had a U.N. credential for going to war. If the language is clear, and we hope that the new language is indeed clear, it will not give an obvious key for going to war. It will not use language that could imply the legitimacy of a unilateral war. Even using the words material breach do not legally require the definition of going to war in response. It can be interpreted that way, and unfortunately, of course, the U.S. has indicated that it intends to interpret it that way. But we should be very clear that because the U.S. says that material breach means war, or because severe consequences means war, that those are agreed to terms for the rest of the international community. In fact, the rest of the world will be saying this is not an authorization for war. And the issue, I think, that's at stake is not only whether or not the words material breach appear in the resolution, but whether other words appear with them, such as the reference that France is trying to impose that would say material breach as determined by the Security Council, which makes very clear that the Council is the only agent allowed, authorized, to make a decision about whether a material breach has occurred. So this is a very important aspect. It sounds very technical, it sounds very legalistic, but in fact it's going to make all the difference between whether or not the U.S., if it chooses to go to war, will be able to legitimately claim it had U.S. backing, or whether its claim of U.N. backing will be said publicly and overtly, and we will all be able to say it, that it's a lie, that it does not have U.N. backing.
What are the consequences, you feel, for the United States if the weasel words, so to speak, are not in a resolution in the end, that they clearly can't interpret the resolution as a justification for war that they may proceed with in the next few months?
Well, I think a lot of that, Scott, depends on all of us who are against going to war and how we are able to do the kind of education and media work that will be required. And it will be a very difficult task because, as we've seen has happened in the past, the U.S. has made it a habit to say, we think we already have all the resolutions that we need. We think we have all the permission that we need because we don't think we need any permission from the United Nations. We have the Congress having approved us to go to war. And, of course, that has nothing to do with international law. The U.S. Congress, like any other parliament, is not authorized to make decisions about how to implement international peace and security. No government has the right to make that decision. Only the Security Council collectively has that right, has that authority in the UN Charter. So I think what we have to be looking at is, one, what is the response of the United States to the, whatever the new text is, and we have to take on ourselves the responsibility to hold the U.S. accountable to what the resolution actually says. And if the resolution, as we can be sure, will not authorize war, we have to say from the beginning, if this resolution is passed on Thursday, by Thursday night, we have to be out there writing the letters to the editor and calling the radio talk shows and going on the radio and doing all those things to say, this resolution is a triumph for diplomacy. This is not a call to war. And if the U.S. uses this to go to war, they will be standing in complete violation of international law, and the U.S. government will be acting as a rogue state.
That was Phyllis Bennis with the Institute for Policy Studies. Contact the Institute by calling area code 202-234-9382 or visit their website at www.ips-dc.org. When Meher Arar, a man holding joint Canadian-Syrian citizenship, changed planes at New York's Kennedy International Airport on September 26th, the U.S. Immigration and Naturalization Service detained and eventually deported him to Syria. The action by the U.S. State Department prompted the Canadian government to protest and issue an unprecedented travel advisory, warning their citizens born in several Middle East and South Asian countries targeted by the U.S. for anti-terror scrutiny to avoid traveling to the United States. A Canadian Foreign Affairs Department official, Renel Doiron, charged that the U.S. policy is discriminatory because it targets citizens based on where they were born. Canada believes that their citizens should be exempt from new measures established by Washington 1 year after the September 11th terrorist attacks. The U.S. National Security Entry-Exit Registration System authorizes the INS to photograph, fingerprint, and closely monitor visitors to America born in Syria, Iran, Iraq, Libya, and Sudan. Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with attorney Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights, about these new U.S. travel regulations and the balance between legitimate security concerns and the rights of foreign nationals who visit America.
It's a real shocker, and it's a real shocker on many different levels, both that the guy was actually disappeared for a while, somewhat like the 9/11s, but even worse, then deported back to a country that he was born in and was essentially a national of, but was not a citizen of in the sense that he was a citizen of Canada, lived in Canada for 9 or 10 years, and was really a citizen of Canada. He was coming back from somewhere in Europe, I think, coming back through Kennedy. They take him off the plane when he's switching planes. And the reason they took him off is not, I don't think, because they had any evidence that he was a terrorist, but a new law was passed saying that people from five countries had to fill out a special form when they came into the United States. And, of course, not knowing that about this new law being passed, and especially used to transit, just going from one plane to another, he apparently didn't fill out the form and gets taken off and gets put into custody and detention. Eventually, the Canadians get notified about the guy, but are just told he's there. They never get told that he's going to be sent to Syria. And when I say back to Syria, I wouldn't really say it that way, because back to Syria is not where he came from. He was simply born in Syria, but he was living and a Canadian citizen. The Canadians say they object, that he wanted him back in Canada. They don't have any evidence that the guy's a terrorist or anything. Without telling the Canadians, without telling us, I mean, lawyers from my office who work on the case kept calling and saying, where is he? We were about to file a habeas corpus just to find out where he was, because the U.S. wouldn't tell us and wouldn't even tell the Canadian government. And then we find out a couple of days later that he's been sent back to Syria, where he's in a Syrian jail, no less. You know, apparently he hadn't done military service or something in Syria. So a truly remarkable case. I mean, just remarkable, because it's not just me as, you know, a progressive lawyer saying, Jesus, what do they do here? But the facts are incredible, and you have the Canadian government, one of the U.S.'s closest allies, objecting, saying, what are you doing with one of our citizens? And the U.S. does it anyway. It really shows you, and it really goes into what I was saying about both non-citizens and the treatment they're receiving, as well as the idea of executive detentions, that the executive can basically take people anywhere in the world and do what they want to them. What's really shocking, of course, now is that the Canadian government actually issued a travel advisory. I mean, travel advisories are the kinds of things the United States issues, you know, when we're dropping the bombs out of, you know, all over Afghanistan, and they say American citizens shouldn't go there. This one is amazing. It's a one-page sheet that says, basically, citizens of the following countries, I mean, citizens, nationals who were born in those countries, but who maybe who are Canadian citizens, should not travel to the United States because they are taking a risk of being sent back to their countries. I mean, is that not unbelievable and remarkable? Our ally is actually issuing a travel advisory about the country next door to it, that it is close to the United States as two fingers on my hand, both literally and actually in politics. You don't need me to say the government of the United States is acting in a high-handed way. All you have to do is look at the Canadians and what they did in this travel advisory.
The officials in the Justice Department that deported this Canadian national to Syria justified on the grounds that post-September 11th, this nation really has to watch out for foreign nationals who come to our shores wishing and planning to do us harm. But I find it very ironic that Saudi Arabia was not on the list of countries whose citizens are exposed to this kind of treatment. But how do you respond
Isn't
to that?
Isn't that amazing? I mean, you know, that's the other thing that makes you wonder about whether they're really after terrorism or after something else here, or they're just passing laws that they would like to put into effect.
I just need to remind our listeners, the reason I say Saudi Arabia not being included in that list is ironic, and I'm sure as you all know, the predominant nation of origin for those citizens who flew the planes into the Pentagon and the World Trade Center were, of course, from Saudi Arabia.
Right, I think either 15 out of 19 or 17 out of 19, I don't recall, but as you said, the predominant majority, but almost all of them were from Saudi Arabia. There's many people who believe that one of the reasons that 9/11 was gotten away with was because we looked the other way when it came to Saudi Arabia. Not that I think the U.S. was behind 9/11, but I think there was no political will to really investigate Saudis that were doing that should have been investigated. When the U.S. issued these special new visa requirements, they issued it for five of the six or five out of the seven countries on the terrorist list, and they didn't issue it for Saudi Arabia. Which seems just ridiculous. If you're really interested in catching terrorists, it would seem to me the place you want to look at is Saudi Arabia. And in fact, there's a good argument to be made that the terrorists purposely used Saudis because they knew the U.S. wouldn't be looking at them. And here the U.S. basically doubles that problem by now on this whole new visa requirement of fingerprinting, you know, and photographing and signing, whatever the other little details of it are. They exclude Saudis. It's astounding. I mean, you add all this up. What the U.S. didn't do to stop 9/11 and, you know, how it should have done this and looked at the Saudis and, you know, Mousawi and the two guys who were living with an FBI informant, you know, all that stuff. It just looks like they're utter bunglers. And, I mean, that looks like that way to me.
That was Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights. Contact the center at area code 212 212- 614-6464 or visit the group's website at www.ccr-ny.org.
No more, no more, stop the drill, the cellar door. Echo the voices of the world. We cry out, no more, no more, no more, no more. We must stop the dirty war. Compañeros, compañeras, we cry out, no more, no more.
Tens of thousands of protesters and those willing to commit nonviolent civil disobedience are preparing to converge on the U.S. Army's School of the Americas, based at Fort Benning in Columbus, Georgia. Over the decades, thousands of Latin American soldiers have been trained, at U.S. government expense, purportedly to instill respect for democracy. But, opponents point out, many of these high-ranking military men have returned to their home countries to carry out murder, rape, and repression against their own people. School of the Americas Watch was founded by Father Roy Bourgeois, a Maryknoll priest who, while serving in Latin America, got to know some of the six Jesuits who were killed by the Salvadoran military in 1989. An investigation traced their murders to soldiers who had been trained at the U.S. School of the Americas. The annual protest actions at Fort Benning, now in its 13th year, are held November 15th through the 17th, the anniversary of those murders. Last year, the school was renamed the Western Hemisphere Institute for Security Cooperation, but opponents assert that a new name has changed nothing. They continue their campaign, demanding that Congress cut funding to the school and close it down. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Father Bourgeois about the movement to close the School of the Americas and the upcoming protest.
This school, well known as a school of assassins, you know, it's become a teachable moment for us. We can look at this school in our backyard, all paid for by our tax money to the tune of about $20 million a year. They started sending us to prison in the early days and continued. Their intention was to try and kill the movement. But what happened, every time they would send us to prison, it simply would energize the movement. And we knew so little about this school. We came here and started to do research, and what we found really in our backyard here at Fort Benning, Georgia, was a combat school that every year trained about 1,000 soldiers from 18 countries in Latin America. And we began to document hundreds of them who were very, very connected to crimes against their people, massacres, disappearances, torture, rape. Now, in 1996, the school got in big trouble when it was discovered that at the school there were these manuals they had been using for 12 years that advocated torture, that made the front pages of the newspapers around the country, front page of the Washington Post. It got a lot of attention there in Congress, and they voted shortly thereafter to cut off funding to the school, to close it. However, while it won in the House of Representatives, it lost by one vote in the Senate, in a conference committee. So they came up with this plan to change the name of the school, and by a very close vote, 204 to 214, last year the name of the school was changed from the School of the Americas to the Western Hemisphere Institute for Security Cooperation. But I'm happy to say that nobody's been fooled by this. This is still a combat school. It's still about arming and training these soldiers from Latin America to go back to their home countries, to provide the muscle for U.S. foreign policy, to protect the economic interests of the large corporations and the sweatshops.
Last year, the new head of the school explained that the school's mission is moving away from training in purely military skills to working in things like humanitarian and disaster relief. Would you comment on that?
Well, this is what they're saying. What they're really pushing is this issue of democracy, that they're now teaching democracy at this school and teaching these soldiers to be subordinate to civilians. Of course, they're doing this at a Army post, Fort Benning, Georgia. Now, I and others, many others in this movement who were in the military, we know one thing is you don't learn democracy in the military. You don't teach democracy behind the barrel of a gun. This is a combat school. nor do you teach these soldiers to be subordinate to civilians at a military installation. If they're really serious about teaching democracy and human rights, they would send these soldiers to some of our fine U.S. universities. These soldiers are learning skills that will not help their people in any way. Their people in Latin America, most of them struggling for survival. And we look at the curriculum, what they're learning here at this combat school, and we see something very important. That what they are learning in no way will help improve the quality of life of their people. Their people do not need more commandos. They don't need their soldiers, you know, learning counterinsurgency techniques, psychological warfare. They need, you know, agronomists. They need healthcare workers, teachers. President Bush keeps saying that we've got to go after those training camps for the terrorists wherever they exist. And what better place to start than in our backyard here at Fort Benning, Georgia, at this school?
What's the status of the bill in Congress now to close the school?
We have in Congress H.R. 1810. It's an important bill. It cuts off the funding to the school, shuts it down forever. At present, we have 112 co-sponsors, with Iraq dominating everything on Capitol Hill today. It's very difficult to get movement on our bill. However, we met in Washington recently with the chief co-sponsor, one of them, Jim McGovern from Massachusetts, and other representatives. And they assured us that they will continue, of course, to work on this bill. They hope to see a vote on this bill next spring. So letters today and in the near future about H.R. 1810. Letters to representatives and senators that they support this bill. It's very important. This year we will have some in our movement who feel, in a sense, called to go on to Fort Benning to try to keep alive the memory of the victims, to speak for them. And, of course, if they go to prison, they will do as those before them. They will speak from prison. And they, too, will help energize our movement.
That was Father Roy Bourgeois of School of the Americas Watch. The protest takes place this year from November 15th to the 17th. For more information, call area code 202-903-7257 or visit the group's website at www.soaw.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, or would like a recording of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756. Or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mikata. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris, with the assistance of Sasha Summer-Cousineau, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.